7. The Unfoldment of World Civilization. March the 11th, 1936. To the beloved of God and the handmaids of the merciful throughout the West, friends and fellow heirs of the grace of Baha'u'llah, as your co-sharer in the building up of the New World Order, which the mind of Baha'u'llah has visioned, and whose features the pen of Abdu'l-Bahá, its perfect architect, has delineated, I pause to contemplate with you the scene which the revolution of well-nigh 15 years after his passing unfolds before us. The contrast between the accumulating evidences of steady consolidation that accompany the rise of the administrative order of the faith of God, and the forces of disintegration which batter at the fabric of a travailing society, is as clear as it is arresting. Both within and outside the Baha'i world, the signs and tokens which, in a mysterious manner, are heralding the birth of that world order, the establishment of which must signalize the golden age of the cause of God, are growing and multiplying day by day. No fair-minded observer can any longer fail to discern them. He cannot be misled by the painful slowness characterizing the unfoldment of the civilization which the followers of Baha'u'llah are laboring to establish. Nor can he be deluded by the ephemeral manifestations of returning prosperity, which at times appear to be capable of checking the disruptive influence of the chronic ills afflicting the institutions of a decaying age. The signs of the times are too numerous and compelling to allow him to mistake their character or to belittle their significance. He can, if he be fair in his judgment, recognize in the chain of events which proclaim on the one hand the irresistible march of the institutions directly associated with the revelation of Baha'u'llah, and foreshadow on the other the downfall of those powers and principalities that have either ignored or opposed it. He can recognize in them all evidences of the operation of God's all-pervasive will, the shaping of his perfectly ordered and world-embracing plan. Soon, Baha'u'llah's own words proclaim it, will the present-day order be rolled up and a new one spread out in its stead. Verily, thy Lord speaketh the truth and is the knower of things unseen. By myself, he solemnly asserts, the day is approaching when we will have rolled up the world and all that is therein, and spread out a new order in its stead. He verily is powerful over all things. The world's equilibrium, he explains, hath been upset through the vibrating influence of this most great, this new world order. Mankind's ordered life hath been revolutionized through the agency of this unique, this wondrous system, the like of which mortal eyes have never witnessed. The signs of impending convulsions and chaos, he warns the peoples of the world, can now be discerned, inasmuch as the prevailing order appeareth to be lamentably defective. Dearly beloved friends, this new world order, whose promise is enshrined in the revelation of Baha'u'llah, whose fundamental principles have been enunciated in the writings of the center of his covenant, involves no less than the complete unification of the entire human race. This unification should conform to such principles as would directly harmonize with the spirit that animates and the laws that govern the operation of the institutions that already constitute the structural basis of the administrative order of his faith. No machinery falling short of the standard inculcated by the Baha'i revelation and at variance with the sublime pattern ordained in his teachings, which the collective efforts of mankind may yet devise, can ever hope to achieve anything above or beyond that lesser peace to which the author of our faith has himself alluded in his writings. Now that ye have refused the most great peace, he, admonishing the kings and rulers of the earth, has written, hold ye fast unto this the lesser peace, that haply ye may, in some degree, better your own condition and that of your dependents. Expiating on this lesser peace, he thus addresses in that same tablet the rulers of the earth. Be reconciled among yourselves, that ye may need no more armaments, save in a measure to safeguard your territories and dominions. Be united, O kings of the earth, for thereby will the tempest of discord be stilled amongst you, and your peoples find rest, if ye be of them that comprehend. Should any one among you take up arms against another, rise ye all against him, for this is naught but manifest justice. The most great peace, on the other hand, as conceived by Baha'u'llah, a peace that must inevitably follow as the practical consequence of the spiritualization of the world and the fusion of all its races, creeds, classes, and nations, can rest on no other basis and can be preserved through no other agency except the divinely appointed ordinances that are implicit in the world order that stands associated with his holy name. In his tablet, revealed almost 70 years ago to Queen Victoria, Baha'u'llah, alluding to this most great peace, has declared, that which the Lord hath ordained as the sovereign remedy and mightiest instrument for the healing of all the world is the union of all its peoples in one universal cause, one common faith. This can in no wise be achieved except through the power of a skilled, an all-powerful and inspired physician. This verily is the truth, and all else naught but error. Consider these days in which the ancient beauty, he who is the most great name, hath been sent down to regenerate and unify mankind. Behold how with drawn swords they rose against him and committed that which caused the faithful spirit to tremble. And whenever we said unto them, lo, the world reformer is come, they made reply, he in truth is one of the stirrers of mischief. It beseemeth all men in this day, he in another tablet asserts, to take firm hold on the most great name and to establish the unity of all mankind. There is no place to flee to, no refuge that anyone can seek except him. Humanity's coming of age. The revelation of Baha'u'llah, whose supreme mission is none other but the achievement of this organic and spiritual unity of the whole body of nations, should, if we be faithful to its implications, be regarded as signalizing through its advent the coming of age of the entire human race. It should be viewed not merely as yet another spiritual revival in the ever-changing fortunes of mankind, not only as a further stage in a chain of progressive revelations, nor even as the culmination of one of a series of recurrent prophetic cycles, but rather as marking the last and highest stage in the stupendous evolution of man's collective life on this planet. The emergence of a world community, the consciousness of world citizenship, the founding of a world civilization and culture, all of which must synchronize with the initial stages in the unfoldment of the golden age of the Baha'i era, should by their very nature be regarded, as far as this planetary life is concerned, as the furthermost limits in the organization of human society. Though man, as an individual, will, nay, must indeed, as a result of such a consummation, continue indefinitely to progress and develop. That mystic, all-pervasive, yet indefinable change which we associate with the stage of maturity inevitable in the life of the individual and the development of the fruit must, if we would correctly apprehend the utterances of Baha'u'llah, have its counterpart in the evolution of the organization of human society. A similar stage must sooner or later be attained in the collective life of mankind, producing an even more striking phenomenon in world relations and endowing the whole human race with such potentialities of well-being as shall provide throughout the succeeding ages the chief incentive required for the eventual fulfillment of its high destiny. Such a stage of maturity in the process of human government must for all time, if we would faithfully recognize the tremendous claim advanced by Baha'u'llah, remain identified with the revelation of which he was the bearer. In one of the most characteristic passages he himself has revealed, he testifies in a language that none can mistake to the truth of this distinguishing principle of Baha'i belief. It hath been decreed by us that the word of God and all the potentialities thereof shall be manifested unto men in strict conformity with such conditions as have been foreordained by him who is the all-knowing, the all-wise. Should the word be allowed to release suddenly all the energies latent within it, no man could sustain the weight of so mighty a revelation. Consider that which hath been sent down unto Muhammad, the apostle of God. The measure of the revelation of which he was the bearer had been clearly foreordained by him who is the Almighty, the All-Powerful. They that heard him, however, could apprehend his purpose only to the extent of their station and spiritual capacity. He, in like manner, uncovered the face of wisdom in proportion to their ability to sustain the burden of his message. No sooner had mankind attained the stage of maturity than the word revealed to men's eyes the latent energies with which it had been endowed, energies which manifested themselves in the plenitude of their glory when the ancient beauty appeared in the year 60 in the person of Ali Muhammad the Bab. Abdu'l-Bahá, elucidating this fundamental verity, has written, "All created things have their degree or stage of maturity. The period of maturity in the life of a tree is the time of its fruit-bearing. The animal attains a stage of full growth and completeness, and in the human kingdom, man reaches his maturity when the light of his intelligence attains its greatest power and development. Similarly, there are periods and stages in the collective life of humanity. At one time, it was passing through its stage of childhood, at another, its period of youth, but now it has entered its long predicted phase of maturity, the evidences of which are everywhere apparent. That which was applicable to human needs during the early history of the race can neither meet nor satisfy the demands of this day, this period of newness and consummation. Humanity has emerged from its former state of limitation and preliminary training. Man must now become imbued with new virtues and powers, new moral standards, new capacities. New bounties, perfect bestowals are awaiting and already descending upon him. The gifts and blessings of the period of youth, although timely and sufficient during the adolescence of mankind, are now incapable of meeting the requirements of its maturity. The process of integration. Such a unique and momentous crisis in the life of organized mankind may, moreover, be likened to the culminating stage in the political evolution of the great American Republic, the stage which marked the emergence of a unified community of federated states, the stirring of a new national consciousness, and the birth of a new type of civilization, infinitely richer and nobler than any which its component parts could have severally hoped to achieve, may be said to have proclaimed the coming of age of the American people. Within the territorial limits of this nation, this consummation may be viewed as the culmination of the process of human government, the diversified and loosely related elements of a divided community were brought together, unified, and incorporated into one coherent system. Though this entity may continue gaining in cohesive power, though the unity already achieved may be further consolidated, though the civilization to which that unity could alone have given birth may expand and flourish, yet the machinery essential to such an enfoldment may be said to have been, in its essential structure, erected, and the impulse required to guide and sustain it may be regarded as having been fundamentally imparted. No stage above and beyond this consummation of national unity can, within the geographical limits of that nation, be imagined, though the highest destiny of its people, as a constituent element in a still larger entity that will embrace the whole of mankind, may still remain unfulfilled. Considered as an isolated unit, however, this process of integration may be said to have reached its highest and final consummation. Such is the stage to which an evolving humanity is collectively approaching. The revelation entrusted by the Almighty Ordainer to Baha'u'llah, his followers firmly believe, has been endowed with such potentialities as are commensurate with the maturity of the human race, the crowning and most momentous stage in its evolution from infancy to manhood. The successive founders of all past religions, who from time immemorial have shed with ever-increasing intensity the splendor of one common revelation at the various stages which have marked the advance of mankind towards maturity, may thus, in a sense, be regarded as preliminary manifestations anticipating and paving the way for the advent of that day of days when the whole earth will have fructified and the tree of humanity will have yielded its destined fruit. Incontrovertible as is this truth, its challenging character should never be allowed to obscure the purpose or distort the principle underlying the utterances of Baha'u'llah, utterances that have established for all time the absolute oneness of all the prophets, himself included, whether belonging to the past or to the future. Though the mission of the prophets preceding Baha'u'llah may be viewed in that light, though the measure of divine revelation with which each has been entrusted must, as a result of this process of evolution, necessarily differ, Their common origin, their essential unity, their identity of purpose should at no time and under no circumstances be misapprehended or denied. That all the messengers of God should be regarded as abiding in the same tabernacle, soaring in the same heaven, seated upon the same throne, uttering the same speech and proclaiming the same faith. Must, however much we may extol the measure of divine revelation vouchsafed to mankind at this crowning stage of its evolution, remain the unalterable foundation and central tenet of Baha'i belief. Any variations in the splendor with which each of these manifestations of the light of God has shed upon the world should be ascribed not to any inherent superiority involved in the essential character of any one of them, but rather to the progressive capacity, the ever-increasing spiritual receptiveness, which mankind, in its progress towards maturity, has invariably manifested. The final consummation. Only those who are willing to associate the revelation proclaimed by Baha'u'llah with the consummation of so stupendous an evolution in the collective life of the whole human race can grasp the significance of the words which he, while alluding to the glories of this promised day and to the duration of the Baha'i era, has deemed fit to utter. "This is the King of Days," he exclaims. "The day that hath seen the coming of the best beloved, him who, through all eternity, hath been acclaimed the desire of the world. The scriptures of past dispensations," he further asserts, "celebrate the great jubilee that must needs greet this most great day of God. Well is it with him that hath lived to see this day and hath recognized its station." It is evident, he in another passage explains, that every age in which a manifestation of God hath lived is divinely ordained and may in a sense be characterized as God's appointed day. This day, however, is unique and is to be distinguished from those that have preceded it. The designation Seal of the Prophets fully revealeth its high station. The prophetic cycle hath verily ended. The eternal truth is now come. He hath lifted up the ensign of power and is now shedding upon the world the unclouded splendor of his revelation. In this most mighty revelation, he in categorical language declares, all the dispensations of the past have attained their highest, their final consummation. That which hath been made manifest in this preeminent, this most exalted revelation standeth unparalleled in the annals of the past, nor will future ages witness its like. Abdu'l-Bahá's authentic pronouncements should, likewise, be recalled as confirming in no less emphatic manner the unexampled vastness of the Baha'i dispensation. Centuries, he affirms in one of his tablets, nay, countless ages must pass away ere the day star of truth shineth again in its midsummer splendor, or appeareth once more in the radiance of its vernal glory. The mere contemplation of the dispensation inaugurated by the Blessed Beauty would have sufficed to overwhelm the saints of bygone ages, saints who longed to partake for one moment of its great glory. Concerning the manifestations that will come down in the future in the shadow of the clouds, he in a still more definite language affirms, know verily, that insofar as their relation to the source of their inspiration is concerned, they are under the shadow of the ancient beauty. In their relation, however, to the age in which they appear, each and every one of them doeth whatsoever he willeth. This holy dispensation, he, alluding to the revelation of Baha'u'llah, explains, is illumined with the light of the Sun of Truth shining from its most exalted station, and in the plenitude of its resplendency, its heat and glory. Pangs of death and birth. Dearly beloved friends, though the revelation of Baha'u'llah has been delivered, the world order, which such a revelation must needs beget, is as yet unborn. Though the heroic age of his faith is past, the creative energies which that age has released have not as yet crystallized into that world society which in the fullness of time is to mirror forth the brightness of his glory. Though the framework of his administrative order has been erected, and the formative period of the Baha'i era has begun, yet the promised kingdom, into which the seed of his institutions must ripen, remains as yet uninaugurated. Though his voice has been raised, and the ensigns of his faith have been lifted up in no less than 40 countries of both the East and the West, yet the wholeness of the human race is as yet unrecognized, its unity unproclaimed, and the standard of its most great peace unhoisted. The heights, Baha'u'llah himself testifies, which through the most gracious favor of God, mortal man can attain in this day, are as yet unrevealed to his sight. The world of being hath never had, nor doth it yet possess, the capacity for such a revelation. The day, however, is approaching when the potentialities of so great a favor will, by virtue of his behest, be manifested unto men. For the revelation of so great a favor, a period of intense turmoil and widespread suffering would seem to be indispensable. Resplendent as has been the age that has witnessed the inception of the mission with which Baha'u'llah has been entrusted, the interval which must elapse ere that age yields its choicest fruit must, it is becoming increasingly apparent, be overshadowed by such moral and social gloom as can alone prepare an unrepentant humanity for the prize she is destined to inherit. Into such a period we are now steadily and irresistibly moving. Amidst the shadows which are increasingly gathering about us, we can faintly discern the glimmerings of Baha'u'llah's unearthly sovereignty appearing fitfully on the horizon of history. To us, the generation of the half-light, living at a time which may be designated as the period of the incubation of the world commonwealth envisaged by Baha'u'llah, has been assigned a task whose high privilege we can never sufficiently appreciate, and the arduousness of which we can as yet but dimly recognize. We may well believe, we who are called upon to experience the operation of the dark forces destined to unloose a flood of agonizing afflictions, that the darkest hour that must precede the dawn of the golden age of our faith has not yet struck. Deep as is the gloom that already encircles the world, the afflictive ordeals which that world is to suffer are still in preparation, nor can their blackness be as yet imagined. We stand on the threshold of an age whose convulsions proclaim alike the death pangs of the old order and the birth pangs of the new. Through the generating influence of the faith announced by Baha'u'llah, this new world order may be said to have been conceived. We can at the present moment experience its stirrings in the womb of the travailing age, an age waiting for the appointed hour at which it can cast its burden and yield its fairest fruit. The whole earth, writes Baha'u'llah, is now in a state of pregnancy. The day is approaching when it will have yielded its noblest fruits, when from it will have sprung forth the loftiest trees, the most enchanting blossoms, the most heavenly blessings. Immeasurably exalted is the breeze that wafteth from the garment of thy Lord, the Glorified. For lo, it hath breathed its fragrance and made all things new. Well is it with them that comprehend. The onrushing winds of the grace of God, he in the Surratul Haykal proclaims, have passed over all things. Every creature hath been endowed with all the potentialities it can carry, and yet the peoples of the world have denied this grace. Every tree hath been endowed with the choicest fruits, every ocean enriched with the most luminous gems. Man himself hath been invested with the gifts of understanding and knowledge. The whole creation hath been made the recipient of the revelation of the All-Merciful, and the earth the repository of things inscrutable to all except God, the Truth, the Knower of things unseen. The time is approaching when every created thing will have cast its burden. Glorified be God, who hath vouchsafed this grace that encompasseth all things, whether seen or unseen. The call of God, Abdu'l-Bahá has written, when raised, breathed a new life into the body of mankind and infused a new spirit into the whole creation. It is for this reason that the world hath been moved to its depths and the hearts and consciences of men been quickened. Ere long the evidences of this regeneration will be revealed, and the fast asleep will be awakened. Universal fermentation. As we view the world around us, we are compelled to observe the manifold evidences of that universal fermentation which in every continent of the globe and in every department of human life, be it religious, social, economic, or political, is purging and reshaping humanity in anticipation of the day when the wholeness of the human race will have been recognized and its unity established. A twofold process, however, can be distinguished, each tending in its own way and with an accelerated momentum to bring to a climax the forces that are transforming the face of our planet. The first is essentially an integrating process, while the second is fundamentally disruptive. The former, as it steadily evolves, unfolds a system which may well serve as a pattern for that world polity towards which a strangely disordered world is continually advancing, while the latter, as its disintegrating influence deepens, tends to tear down with increasing violence the antiquated barriers that seek to block humanity's progress towards its destined goal. The constructive process stands associated with the nascent faith of Baha'u'llah and is the harbinger of the new world order that faith must, ere long, establish. The destructive forces that characterize the other should be identified with a civilization that has refused to answer to the expectation of a new age and is consequently falling into chaos and decline. A titanic, a spiritual struggle, unparalleled in its magnitude, yet unspeakably glorious in its ultimate consequences, is being waged as a result of these opposing tendencies in this age of transition through which the organized community of the followers of Baha'u'llah and mankind as a whole are passing. The spirit that has incarnated itself in the institutions of a rising faith has, in the course of its onward march for the redemption of the world, encountered and is still now battling with such forces as are, in most instances, the very negation of that spirit, and whose continued existence must inevitably hinder it from achieving its purpose. The hollow and outworn institutions, the obsolete doctrines and beliefs, the effete and discredited traditions which these forces represent, it should be observed, have in certain instances been undermined by virtue of their senility, the loss of their cohesive power, and their own inherent corruption. A few have been swept away by the onrushing forces which the Baha'i faith has, at the hour of its birth, so mysteriously released. Others, as a direct result of a vain and feeble resistance to its rise in the initial stages of its development, have died out and been utterly discredited. Still others, fearful of the pervasive influence of the institutions in which that same spirit had at a later stage been embodied, had mobilized their forces and launched their attack, destined to sustain in their turn, after a brief and illusory success, an ignominious defeat. This age of transition. It is not my purpose to call to mind, much less to attempt a detailed analysis of the spiritual struggles that have ensued, or to note the victories that have redounded to the glory of the faith of Baha'u'llah since the day of its foundation. My chief concern is not with the happenings that have distinguished the apostolic age of the Baha'i dispensation, but rather with the outstanding events that are transpiring in and the tendencies which characterize the formative period of its development, this age of transition, whose tribulations are the precursors of that era of blissful felicity, which is to incarnate God's ultimate purpose for all mankind. To the catastrophic fall of mighty kingdoms and empires, on the eve of Abdu'l-Bahá's departure, whose passing may be said to have ushered in the opening phase of the age of transition in which we now live, I have in a previous communication briefly alluded. The dissolution of the German Empire, the humiliating defeat inflicted upon its ruler, the successor and lineal descendant of the Prussian king and emperor to whom Baha'u'llah had addressed his solemn and historic warning, together with the extinction of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, the remnant of the once great Holy Roman Empire, were both precipitated by a war whose outbreak signalized the opening of the age of frustration destined to precede the establishment of the world order of Baha'u'llah. Both of these momentous events may be viewed as the earliest occurrences of that turbulent age into the outer fringes of whose darkest phase we are now beginning to enter. To the conqueror of Napoleon III, the author of Our Faith had, on the morrow of the king's victory, addressed in his most holy book this clear and ominous warning. O King of Berlin, take heed lest pride debar thee from recognizing the dayspring of divine revelation, lest earthly desires shut thee out, as by a veil, from the Lord of the throne above and of the earth below. Thus counselleth thee the pen of the Most High. He verily is the most gracious, the all-bountiful. Do thou remember the one whose power transcended thy power, Napoleon III, and whose station excelled thy station. Where is he? Whither are gone the things he possessed? Take warning, and be not of them that are fast asleep. He it was who cast the tablet of God behind him, when we made known unto him what the hosts of tyranny had caused us to suffer. Wherefore disgrace assailed him from all sides, and he went down to dust in great loss. Think deeply, O King, concerning him, and concerning them who, like unto thee, have conquered cities and ruled over men. The All-Merciful brought them down from their palaces to their graves. Be warned, be of them who reflect. O banks of the Rhine, Baha'u'llah, in another passage of that same book prophesies, we have seen you covered with gore, inasmuch as the swords of retribution were drawn against you. And so you shall have another turn. And we hear the lamentations of Berlin, though she be today in conspicuous glory. Collapse of Islam. The collapse of the power of the Shia hierarchy in a land which had for centuries been one of the impregnable strongholds of Muslim fanaticism was the inevitable consequence of that wave of secularization which at a later time was to invade some of the most powerful and conservative ecclesiastical institutions in both the European and American continents. Though not the direct outcome of the last war, this sudden trembling which had seized this hitherto immovable pillar of Islamic orthodoxy accentuated the problems and deepened the restlessness with which a war-weary world was being afflicted. Shia Islam had lost once for all in Baha'u'llah's native land, and as the direct consequence of its implacable hostility to his faith, its combative power had forfeited its rights and privileges, had been degraded and demoralized, and was being condemned to hopeless obscurity and ultimate extinction. No less than 20,000 martyrs, however, had to sacrifice their lives ere the cause for which they had stood and died could register this initial victory over those who were the first to repudiate its claims and mow down its gallant warriors. Vileness and poverty were stamped upon them, and they returned with wrath from God. Behold, writes Baha'u'llah, commenting on the decline of a fallen people, how the sayings and doings of Shia Islam have dulled the joy and fervour of its early days and tarnished the pristine brilliancy of its light. In its primitive days, whilst they still adhere to the precepts associated with the name of their prophet, the Lord of mankind, their career was marked by an unbroken chain of victories and triumphs. As they gradually strayed from the path of their ideal leader and master, as they turned away from the light of God and corrupted the principle of his divine unity, and as they increasingly centered their attention upon them who were only the revealers of the potency of his word, their power was turned into weakness, their glory into shame, their courage into fear. Thou dost witness to what a pass they have come. The downfall of the Qajar dynasty, the avowed defender and the willing instrument of a decaying clergy, almost synchronized with the humiliation which the Shia ecclesiastical leaders had suffered. From Muhammad Shah down to the last and feeble monarch of that dynasty, the faith of Baha'u'llah was denied the impartial consideration, the disinterested and fair treatment which its cause had rightly demanded. It had, on the contrary, been atrociously harassed, consistently betrayed and prosecuted. The martyrdom of the Bab, the banishment of Baha'u'llah, the confiscation of his earthly possessions, his incarceration in Mazandaran, the reign of terror that confined him in the most pestilential of dungeons, the intrigues, the protests and calumnies which thrice renewed his exile and led to his ultimate imprisonment in the most desolate of cities. The shameful sentences passed with the connivance of the judicial and ecclesiastical authorities against the person, the property and the honour of his innocent followers, these stand out as among the blackest acts for which posterity will hold this blood-stained dynasty responsible. One more barrier that had sought to obstruct the forward march of the faith was now removed. Though Baha'u'llah had been banished from his native land, the tide of calamity which had swept with such fury over him and over the followers of the Bab was by no means receding. Under the jurisdiction of the Sultan of Turkey, the arch-enemy of his cause, a new chapter in the history of his ever-recurring trials had opened. The overthrow of the Sultanate and the Caliphate, the twin pillars of Sunni Islam, can be regarded in no other light except as the inevitable consequence of the fierce, the sustained and deliberate persecution which the monarchs of the tottering house of Osman, the recognized successors of the Prophet Muhammad, had launched against it. From the city of Constantinople, the traditional seat of both the Sultanate and the Caliphate, the rulers of Turkey had, for a period covering almost three quarters of a century, striven with unabated zeal to stem the tide of a faith they feared and abhorred. From the time Baha'u'llah set foot on Turkish soil and was made a virtual prisoner of the most powerful potentate of Islam, to the year of the Holy Land's liberation from Turkish yoke, successive caliphs, and in particular the Sultans Abdul Aziz and Abdul Hamid, had in the full exercise of the spiritual and temporal authority which their exalted office had conferred upon them, afflicted both the founder of our faith and the centre of his covenant with such pain and tribulation as no mind can fathom, nor pen or tongue describe. They alone could have measured or borne them. To these afflictive trials, Baha'u'llah has repeatedly testified, "By the righteousness of the Almighty, were I to recount to thee the tale of the things that have befallen me, the souls and minds of men would be incapable of sustaining its weight. God himself beareth me witness. 20 years have passed," he, addressing the kings of Christendom, has written, "during which we have each day tasted the agony of a fresh tribulation. No one of them that were before us hath endured the things we have endured. Would that ye could perceive it. They that rose up against us have put us to death, have shed our blood, have plundered our property, and violated our honour. Recall to mind my sorrows." He in another connection has revealed, "My cares and anxieties, my woes and trials, the state of my captivity, the tears that I have shed, the bitterness of mine anguish, and now mine imprisonment in this far-off land. Couldst thou be told what hath befallen the ancient beauty, thou wouldst flee into the wilderness and weep with a great weeping. Every morning I arose from my bed, I discovered the hosts of countless afflictions massed behind my door. And every night when I lay down, lo, my heart was torn with agony at what it had suffered from the fiendish cruelty of its foes. The orders which these foes issued, the banishments they decreed, the indignities they inflicted, the plans they devised, the investigations they conducted, the threats they pronounced, the atrocities they were prepared to commit, the intrigues and baseness to which they, their ministers, their governments and military chieftains had stooped, constitute a record which can hardly find a parallel in the history of any revealed religion. The mere recital of the most salient features of that sinister theme would suffice to fill a volume. They knew full well that the spiritual and administrative centre of the cause they had striven to eradicate had now shifted to their dominion, that its leaders were Turkish citizens, and that whatever resources these could command were at their mercy. That for a period of almost 70 years, while still in the plenitude of its unquestioned authority, while reinforced by the endless machinations of the civil and ecclesiastical authorities of a neighbouring nation, and assured of the support of those of Baha'u'llah's kindred who had rebelled against and seceded from his cause, this despotism should have failed in the end to extirpate a mere handful of its condemned subjects, must to every unbelieving observer remain one of the most intriguing and mysterious episodes of contemporary history. The cause of which Baha'u'llah was still the visible leader had, despite the calculations of a short-sighted enemy, undeniably triumphed. No unbiased mind, penetrating the surface of conditions surrounding the prisoner of Acre, could any longer mistake or deny it. Though the tension which had been relaxed was, for a time, heightened after Baha'u'llah's ascension, and the perils of a still unsettled situation were revived, it was becoming increasingly evident that the insidious forces of decay, which for many a long year were eating into the vitals of a diseased nation, were now moving towards a climax. A series of internal convulsions, each more devastating than the previous one, had already been unchained, destined to bring in their wake one of the most catastrophic occurrences of modern times. The murder of that arrogant despot in the year 1876, the Russo-Turkish conflict that soon followed its wake, the wars of liberation which succeeded it, the rise of the Young Turk movement, the Turkish Revolution of 1909 that precipitated the downfall of Abdul Hamid, the Balkan Wars with their calamitous consequences, the liberation of Palestine, enshrining within its bosom the cities of Acre and Haifa, the world centre of an emancipated faith, the further dismemberment decreed by the Treaty of Versailles, the abolition of the Sultanate and the downfall of the House of Osman, the extinction of the Caliphate, the disestablishment of the state religion, the annulment of the Sharia law and the promulgation of a universal civil code, the suppression of various orders, beliefs, traditions, and ceremonials believed to be inextricably interwoven with the fabric of the Muslim faith. These followed with an ease and swiftness that no man had dared envisage. In these devastating blows, administered by friend and foe alike, by Christian nations and professing Muslims, every follower of the persecuted faith of Baha'u'llah recognized evidences of the directing hand of the departed founder of his religion, who, from the invisible realm, was unloosing a flood of well-deserved calamities upon a rebellious religion and nation. Compare the evidences of divine visitation which befell the persecutors of Jesus Christ with these historic retributions, which in the latter part of the first century of the Baha'i era have hurled to dust the chief adversary of the religion of Baha'u'llah. Had not the Roman Emperor, in the second half of the first century of the Christian era, after a distressful siege of Jerusalem, laid waste the holy city, destroyed the temple, desecrated and robbed the Holy of Holies of its treasures, and transported them to Rome, reared a pagan colony on the Mount of Zion, massacred the Jews, and exiled and dispersed the survivors. Compare, moreover, these words which the persecuted Christ, as witnessed by the Gospel, addressed to Jerusalem, with Baha'u'llah's apostrophe to Constantinople, revealed while he lay in his far-off prison and recorded in his most holy book. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings. And again, as he wept over the city, if thou hadst known, even thou, at least in this thy day, the things which belong unto thy peace, but now they are hid from thine eyes, for the days shall come upon thee, that thine enemies shall cast a trench about thee, and compass thee round, and keep thee in on every side, and shall lay thee even with the ground, and thy children within thee, and they shall not leave in thee one stone upon the other, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation. O spot that art situate on the shores of the two seas, Baha'u'llah thus apostrophizes the city of Constantinople. The throne of tyranny hath verily been established upon thee, and the flame of hatred hath been kindled within thy bosom, in such wise that the concourse on high and they who circle around the exalted throne have wailed and lamented. We behold in thee the foolish ruling over the wise, and darkness vaunting itself against the light. Thou art indeed filled with manifest pride. Hath thine outward splendour made thee vainglorious? By him who is the Lord of mankind, it shall soon perish, and thy daughters and thy widows and all the kindreds that dwell within thee shall lament. Thus informeth thee the all-knowing, the all-wise. To Sultan Abdulaziz, the monarch who decreed each of Baha'u'llah's three banishments, the founder of our faith, while a prisoner in the Sultan's capital, addressed these words. Hearken, O King, to the speech of him that speaketh the truth, him that doth not ask thee to recompense him with the things God hath chosen to bestow upon thee, him who unerringly treadeth the straight path. Set before thine eyes God's unerring balance, and as one standing in his presence, weigh in that balance thine actions every day, every moment of thy life. Bring thyself to account, ere thou art summoned to a reckoning, on the day when no man shall have strength to stand for fear of God, the day when the hearts of the heedless ones shall be made to tremble. To the ministers of the Turkish state, he in that same tablet revealed, it behooveth you, O ministers of state, to keep the precepts of God, and to forsake your own laws and regulations, and to be of them who are guided aright. Ye shall ere long discover the consequences of that which ye shall have done in this vain life, and shall be repaid for them. How great the number of those who in bygone ages have committed the things ye have committed, and who, though superior to you in rank, have in the end returned unto dust and been consigned to their inevitable doom. ye shall follow in their wake, and shall be made to enter a habitation wherein none shall be found to befriend or help you. The days of your life shall roll away, and all the things with which ye are occupied and of which ye boast yourselves shall perish, and ye shall most certainly be summoned by a company of his angels to appear at the spot where the limbs of the entire creation shall be made to tremble and the flesh of every oppressor to creep. This is the day that shall inevitably come upon you, the hour that none can put back. To the inhabitants of Constantinople, while he lived the life of an exile in their midst, Baha'u'llah in that same tablet addressed these words: Fear God, ye inhabitants of the city, and sow not the seeds of dissension amongst men. Your days shall pass away, as have the days of them who were before you. To dust shall ye return, even as your fathers of old did return. He moreover remarks, upon our arrival in the city, its governors and elders, as children gathered about and disporting themselves with clay, our inner eye wept sore over them, and over their transgressions and their total disregard of the thing for which they were created. The day is approaching when God will have raised up a people who will call to remembrance our days, who will tell the tale of our trials, who will demand the restitution of our rights from them that without a tittle of evidence have treated us with manifest injustice. God assuredly dominateth the lives of them that wronged us and is well aware of their doings. He will most certainly lay hold on them for their sins. He verily is the fiercest of avengers. Wherefore, he graciously exhorteth them, hearken ye unto my speech, and return ye to God, and repent, that he through his grace may have mercy upon you, may wash away your sins, and forgive your trespasses. The greatness of his mercy surpasseth the fury of his wrath, and his grace encompasseth all who have been called into being and been clothed with the robe of life, be they of the past or of the future. And finally, in the Law Hara'is, we find these prophetic words recorded. Hearken, O chief, to the voice of God, the sovereign, the help in peril, the self-subsisting. Thou hast, O chief, committed that which hath made Mohammed, the apostle of God, groan in the most exalted paradise. The world hath made thee proud, so much so that thou hast turned away from the face through whose brightness the concourse on high hath been illumined. Soon thou shalt find thyself in evident loss. The day is approaching when the land of mystery, Adrianople, and what is beside it, shall be changed and shall pass out of the hands of the king, and commotions shall appear, and the voice of lamentation shall be raised, and the evidences of mischief shall be revealed on all sides, and confusion shall spread by reason of that which hath befallen these captives at the hands of the hosts of oppression. The course of things shall be altered, and conditions shall wax so grievous that the very sands on the desolate hills will mourn, and the trees on the mountain will weep, and blood will flow out of all things. Then wilt thou behold the people in sore distress. 1300 years had to elapse from the death of the Prophet Muhammad ere the illegitimacy of the institution of the Caliphate, the founders of which had usurped the authority of the lawful successors of the Apostle of God, would be fully and publicly demonstrated. an institution which in its inception had trampled upon so sacred a right and unchanged the forces of so distressful a schism, an institution which in the latter days had dealt so grievous a blow to a faith whose forerunner was himself a descendant of the very imams whose authority that institution had repudiated, deserved full well the chastisement that had sealed its fate. The text of certain Mohammedan traditions, the authenticity of which Muslims themselves recognize, and which have been extensively quoted by eminent Oriental Baha'i scholars and authors, will serve to corroborate the argument and illuminate the theme I have attempted to expound. In the latter days, a grievous calamity shall befall my people at the hands of their ruler, a calamity such as no man ever heard to surpass it. So fierce will it be that none can find a shelter. God will then send down one of my descendants, one sprung from my family, who will fill the earth with equity and justice, even as it hath been filled with injustice and tyranny. And again, a day shall be witnessed by my people, whereon there will have remained of Islam naught but a name, and of the Quran naught but a mere appearance. The doctors of that age shall be the most evil the world hath ever seen. Mischief hath proceeded from them, and on them will it recoil. And again, at that hour his malediction shall descend upon you, and your curse shall afflict you, and your religion shall remain an empty word on your tongues. And when these signs appear amongst you, anticipate the day when the red-hot wind will have swept over you, or the day when ye will have been disfigured, or when stones will have rained upon you. O people of the Quran, Baha'u'llah, addressing the combined forces of Sunni and Shia Islam, significantly affirms, verily, the Prophet of God, Muhammad, sheddeth tears at the sight of your cruelty. Ye have assuredly followed your evil and corrupt desires and turned away your face from the light of guidance. Ere long will ye witness the result of your deeds. For the Lord my God lieth in wait and is watchful of your behaviour. O concourse of Muslim divines! By your deeds the exalted station of the people hath been abased, the standard of Islam hath been reversed, and its mighty throne hath fallen. Deterioration of Christian institutions. So much for Islam and the crippling blows its leaders and institutions have received and may yet receive in this the first century of the Baha'i era. If I have dwelt too long on this theme, if I have to a disproportionate degree quoted from the sacred writings in support of my argument, it is solely because of my firm conviction that these retributive calamities that have rained down upon the foremost oppressor of the faith of Baha'u'llah should rank not only among the stirring occurrences of this age of transition, but as some of the most startling and significant events of contemporary history. Both Sunni and Shia Islam had, through the convulsions that had seized them, contributed to the acceleration of the disruptive process to which I have previously referred, a process which by its very nature is to pave the way for that complete reorganization and unification which the world in every aspect of its life must achieve. What of Christianity and of the denominations with which it stands identified? Can it be said that this process of deterioration that has attacked the fabric of the religion of Muhammad has failed to exert its baneful influence on the institutions associated with the faith of Jesus Christ? Have these institutions already experienced the impact of these menacing forces? Are their foundations so secure and their vitality so great as to enable them to resist this onslaught? Will they, as the confusion of a chaotic world spreads and deepens, fall in turn a prey to their violence? Have the more orthodox among them already risen, and if not, will they arise to repel the onset of a cause which, having pulled down the barriers of Muslim orthodoxy, is now advancing into the heart of Christendom in both the European and American continents? Would such a resistance sow the seeds of further dissension and confusion and consequently serve indirectly to hasten the advent of the promised day? To these queries we can but partly answer. Time alone can reveal the nature of the role which the institutions directly associated with the Christian faith are destined to assume in this, the formative period of the Baha'i era, this dark age of transition through which humanity as a whole is passing. Such events as have already transpired, however, are of such a nature as can indicate the direction in which these institutions are moving. We can, in some degree, appraise the probable effect which the forces operating both within the Baha'i faith and outside it will exert upon them. That the forces of irreligion, of a purely materialistic philosophy, of unconcealed paganism have been loosed, are now spreading, and by consolidating themselves are beginning to invade some of the most powerful Christian institutions of the Western world, no unbiased observer can fail to admit. That these institutions are becoming increasingly restive, that a few among them are already dimly aware of the pervasive influence of the cause of Baha'u'llah, that they will, as their inherent strength deteriorates and their discipline relaxes, regard with deepening dismay the rise of his new world order, and will gradually determine to assail it, that such an opposition will in turn accelerate their decline, few, if any, among those who are attentively watching the progress of his faith would be inclined to question. The vitality of man's belief in God, Baha'u'llah has testified, is dying out in every land. Nothing short of his wholesome medicine can ever restore it. The corrosion of ungodliness is eating into the vitals of human society. What else but the elixir of his potent revelation can cleanse and revive it? The world is in turmoil, he has further written, and its agitation waxeth day by day. Its face is turned towards waywardness and unbelief. Such shall be its plight that to disclose it now would not be meet and seemly. The menace of secularism that has attacked Islam and is undermining its remaining institutions, that has invaded Persia, has penetrated into India and raised its triumphant head in Turkey, has already manifested itself in both Europe and America, and is in varying degrees and under various forms and designations challenging the basis of every established religion, and in particular the institutions and communities identified with the faith of Jesus Christ. It would be no exaggeration to say that we are moving into a period which the future historian will regard as one of the most critical in the history of Christianity. Already, a few among the protagonists of the Christian religion admit the gravity of the situation that confronts them. A wave of materialism is sweeping round the world, is the testimony of its missionaries, as witnessed by the text of their official reports. The drive and pressure of modern industrialism, which are penetrating even the forests of Central Africa and the plains of Central Asia, make men everywhere dependent on and preoccupied with material things. At home, the church has talked perhaps too glibly in pulpit or on platform of the menace of secularism, though even in England we can catch more than a glimpse of its meaning. But to the church overseas, these things are grim realities, enemies with which it is at grips. The church has a new danger to face in land after land, determined and hostile attack. From Soviet Russia, a definitely anti-religious communism is pushing west into Europe and America, east into Persia, India, China and Japan. It is an economic theory definitely harnessed to disbelief in God. It is a religious irreligion. It has a passionate sense of mission and is carrying on its anti-God campaign at the church's base at home, as well as launching its offensive against its front line in non-Christian lands. Such a conscious, avowed, organized attack against religion in general and Christianity in particular is something new in history. Equally deliberate in some lands in its determined hostility to Christianity is another form of social and political faith, nationalism. But the nationalist attack on Christianity, unlike communism, is often bound up with some form of national religion, with Islam in Persia and Egypt, with Buddhism in Ceylon, while the struggle for communal rights in India is allied with a revival both of Hinduism and Islam. I need not attempt in this connection an exposition of the origin and character of those economic theories and political philosophies of the post-war period that have directly and indirectly exerted and are still exerting their pernicious influence on the institutions and beliefs connected with one of the most widely spread and best organized religious systems of the world. It is with their influence rather than with their origin that I am chiefly concerned. The excessive growth of industrialism and its attendant evils, as the aforementioned quotation bears witness, the aggressive policies initiated and the persistent efforts exerted by the inspirers and organizers of the communist movement, the intensification of a militant nationalism associated in certain countries with a systematized work of defamation against all forms of ecclesiastical influence have no doubt contributed to the de-Christianization of the masses and been responsible for a notable decline in the authority, the prestige, and power of the church. The whole conception of God, the persecutors of the Christian religion have insistently proclaimed, is a conception derived from the ancient Oriental despotisms. It is a conception quite unworthy of free men. Religion, one of their leaders has asserted, is an opiate of the people. Religion, declares the text of their official publications, is a brutalization of the people. Education must be so directed as to efface from the people's minds this humiliation and this idiocy. The Hegelian philosophy, which in other countries has, in the form of an intolerant and militant nationalism, insisted on deifying the state, has inculcated the war spirit and incited to racial animosity, has likewise led to a marked weakening of the church and to a grave diminution of its spiritual influence. Unlike the bold offensive, which an avowedly atheistic movement had chosen to launch against it, both within the Soviet Union and beyond its confines, this nationalistic philosophy, which Christian rulers and governments have upheld, is an attack directed against the church by those who were previously its professed adherents, a betrayal of its cause by its own kith and kin. It was being stabbed by an alien and militant atheism from without, and by the preachers of a heretical doctrine from within. Both these forces, each operating in its own sphere and using its own weapons and methods, have moreover been greatly assisted and encouraged by the prevailing spirit of modernism, with its emphasis on a purely materialistic philosophy, which as it diffuses itself tends increasingly to divorce religion from man's daily life. The combined effect of these strange and corrupt doctrines, these dangerous and treacherous philosophies, has, as was natural, been severely felt by those whose tenets inculcated an opposite and wholly irreconcilable spirit and principle. The consequences of the clash that inevitably ensued between these contending interests were in some cases disastrous, and the damage that has been wrought irreparable. The disestablishment and dismemberment of the Greek Orthodox Church in Russia, following upon the blow which the Church of Rome had sustained as a result of the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. The commotion that subsequently seized the Catholic Church and culminated in its separation from the state in Spain. The persecution of the same church in Mexico. The perquisitions, arrests, intimidation, and terrorization to which Catholics and Lutherans alike are being subjected in the heart of Europe. The turmoil into which another branch of the church has been thrown as a result of the military campaign in Africa. The decline that has set in the fortunes of Christian missions, both Anglican and Presbyterian, in Persia, Turkey, and the Far East. The ominous signs that foreshadow serious complications in the equivocal and precarious relationships now existing between the Holy See and certain nations in the continent of Europe, these stand out as the most striking features of the reverses which, in almost every part of the world, the members and leaders of Christian ecclesiastical institutions have suffered. That the solidarity of some of these institutions has been irretrievably shattered is too apparent for any intelligent observer to mistake or deny. The cleavage between the fundamentalists and the liberals among their adherents is continually widening. Their creeds and dogmas have been watered down and in certain instances ignored and discarded. Their hold upon human conduct is loosening, and the personnel of their ministries is dwindling in number and in influence. The timidity and insincerity of their preachers are in several instances being exposed. Their endowments have in some countries disappeared, and the force of their religious training has declined. Their temples have been partly deserted and destroyed, and an oblivion of God, of his teachings and of his purpose, has enfeebled and heaped humiliation upon them. Might not this disintegrating tendency, from which Sunni and Shia Islam have so conspicuously suffered, unloose, as it reaches its climax, still further calamities upon the various denominations of the Christian Church? In what manner and how rapidly this process, which has already set in, will develop, the future alone can reveal. Nor can it at the present time be estimated to what extent will the attacks which a still powerful clergy may yet launch against the strongholds of the faith of Baha'u'llah in the West, accentuate this decline and widen the range of inescapable disasters. If Christianity wishes and expects to serve the world in the present crisis, writes a minister of the Presbyterian Church in America, it must cut back through Christianity to Christ. Back through the centuries-old religion about Jesus to the original religion of Jesus. Otherwise, he significantly adds, the Spirit of Christ will live in institutions other than their own. So marked a decline in the strength and cohesion of the elements constituting Christian society has led in its turn, as we might well anticipate, to the emergence of an increasing number of obscure cults, of strange and new worships, of ineffective philosophies whose sophisticated doctrines have intensified the confusion of a troubled age. In their tenets and pursuits, they may be said to reflect and bear witness to the revolt, the discontent, and the confused aspirations of the disillusioned masses that have deserted the cause of the Christian churches and seceded from their membership. A parallel might almost be drawn between these confused and confusing systems of thought that are the direct outcome of the helplessness and confusion afflicting the Christian faith, and the great variety of popular cults, of fashionable and evasive philosophies which flourished in the opening centuries of the Christian era, and which attempted to absorb and pervert the state religion of that Roman people. The pagan worshippers who constituted at that time the bulk of the population of the Western Roman Empire found themselves surrounded and in certain instances menaced by the prevailing sect of the Neoplatonists, by the followers of nature religions, by Gnostic philosophers, by Philonism, Mithraism, the adherents of the Alexandrian cult, and a multitude of kindred sects and beliefs, in much the same way as the defenders of the Christian faith, the preponderating religion of the Western world, are realizing in the first century of the Baha'i era how their influence is being undermined by a flood of conflicting beliefs, practices, and tendencies which their own bankruptcy had helped to create. It was, however, this same Christian religion, which has now fallen into such a state of impotence, that eventually proved itself capable of sweeping away the institutions of paganism, and of swamping and suppressing the cults that had flourished in that age. Such institutions as have strayed far from the spirit and teachings of Jesus Christ must of necessity, as the embryonic world order of Baha'u'llah takes shape and unfolds, recede into the background and make way for the progress of the divinely ordained institutions that stand inextricably interwoven with his teachings. The indwelling Spirit of God, which in the apostolic age of the Church animated its members, the pristine purity of its teachings, the primitive brilliancy of its light, will no doubt be reborn and revived as the inevitable consequence of this redefinition of its fundamental verities and the clarification of its original purpose. For the faith of Baha'u'llah, if we would faithfully appraise it, can never and in no aspect of its teachings be at variance, much less conflict, with the purpose animating or the authority invested in the faith of Jesus Christ. This glowing tribute which Baha'u'llah himself has been moved to pay to the author of the Christian religion stands as sufficient testimony to the truth of this central principle of Baha'i belief. Know thou that when the Son of Man yielded up his breath to God, the whole creation wept with a great weeping. By sacrificing himself, however, a fresh capacity was infused into all created things. Its evidences, as witnessed in all the peoples of the earth, are now manifest before thee. The deepest wisdom which the sages have uttered, the profoundest learning which any mind hath unfolded, the arts which the ablest hands have produced, the influence exerted by the most potent of rulers, are but manifestations of the quickening power released by his transcendent, his all-pervasive and resplendent spirit. We testify that when he came into the world, he shed the splendor of his glory upon all created things. Through him, the leper recovered from the leprosy of perversity and ignorance. Through him, the unchaste and wayward were healed. Through his power, born of Almighty God, the eyes of the blind were opened and the soul of the sinner sanctified. He it is who purified the world. Blessed is the man who with a face beaming with light hath turned towards him. Signs of moral downfall. No more, I believe, need be said of the decline of religious institutions, the disintegration of which constitutes so important an aspect of the formative period of the Baha'i era. Islam had both as a result of the rising tide of secularism and in direct consequence of its declared and persistent hostility to the faith of Baha'u'llah, sunk to a depth of abasement rarely attained in its history. Christianity had likewise, owing to causes not wholly dissimilar to those operating in the case of its sister faith, steadily weakened and was contributing in an increasing measure its share to the process of general disintegration, a process that must necessarily precede the fundamental reconstruction of human society. The signs of moral downfall, as distinct from the evidences of decay in religious institutions, would appear to be no less noticeable and significant. The decline that has set in the fortunes of Islamic and Christian institutions may be said to have had its counterpart in the life and conduct of the individuals that compose them. In whichever direction we turn our gaze, no matter how cursory our observation of the doings and sayings of the present generation, we cannot fail to be struck by the evidences of moral decadence, which in their individual lives, no less than in their collective capacity, men and women around us exhibit. There can be no doubt that the decline of religion as a social force, of which the deterioration of religious institutions is but an external phenomenon, is chiefly responsible for so grave, so conspicuous an evil. Religion, writes Baha'u'llah, is the greatest of all means for the establishment of order in the world and for the peaceful contentment of all that dwell therein. The weakening of the pillars of religion hath strengthened the hands of the ignorant and made them bold and arrogant. Verily I say, whatsoever hath lowered the lofty station of religion hath increased the waywardness of the wicked, and the result cannot be but anarchy. Religion, he in another tablet has stated, is a radiant light and an impregnable stronghold for the protection and welfare of the peoples of the world. For the fear of God impelleth man to hold fast to that which is good and shun all evil. Should the lamp of religion be obscured, chaos and confusion will ensue, and the lights of fairness, of justice, of tranquility and peace cease to shine. Know thou, he in yet another connection has written, that they who are truly wise have likened the world unto the human temple. As the body of man needeth a garment to clothe it, so the body of mankind must needs be adorned with the mantle of justice and wisdom. Its robe is the revelation vouchsafed unto it by God. No wonder, therefore, that when as a result of human perversity, the light of religion is quenched in men's hearts, and the divinely appointed robe designated to adorn the human temple is deliberately discarded, a deplorable decline in the fortunes of humanity immediately sets in, bringing in its wake all the evils which a wayward soul is capable of revealing. The perversion of human nature, the degradation of human conduct, the corruption and disillusion of human institutions reveal themselves under such circumstances in their worst and most revolting aspects. Human character is debased, confidence is shaken, the nerves of discipline are relaxed, the voice of human conscience is stilled, the sense of decency and shame is obscured, conceptions of duty, of solidarity, of reciprocity and loyalty are distorted, and the very feeling of peacefulness, of joy and of hope is gradually extinguished. Such, we might well admit, is the state which individuals and institutions alike are approaching. No two men, Baha'u'llah, lamenting the plight of an erring humanity, has written, can be found who may be said to be outwardly and inwardly united. The evidences of discord and malice are apparent everywhere, though all were made for harmony and union. How long, he in the same tablet exclaims, will humanity persist in its waywardness? How long will injustice continue? How long is chaos and confusion to reign amongst men? How long will discord agitate the face of society? The winds of despair are, alas, blowing from every direction, and the strife that divideth and afflicteth the human race is daily increasing. The recrudescence of religious intolerance, of racial animosity, and of patriotic arrogance. The increasing evidences of selfishness, of suspicion, of fear, and of fraud. The spread of terrorism, of lawlessness, of drunkenness, and of crime. The unquenchable thirst for and the feverish pursuit after earthly vanities, riches, and pleasures. The weakening of family solidarity, the laxity in parental control, the lapse into luxurious indulgence, the irresponsible attitude towards marriage and the consequent rising tide of divorce, the degeneracy of art and music, the infection of literature and the corruption of the press. The extension of the influence and activities of those prophets of decadence who advocate companionate marriage, who preach the philosophy of nudism, who call modesty an intellectual fiction, who refuse to regard the procreation of children as the sacred and primary purpose of marriage, who denounce religion as an opiate of the people, who would, if given free rein, lead back the human race to barbarism, chaos, and ultimate extinction. These appear as the outstanding characteristics of a decadent society, a society that must either be reborn or perish. Breakdown of political and economic structure. Politically, a similar decline, a no less noticeable evidence of disintegration and confusion, can be discovered in the age we live in, the age which a future historian might well recognize to have been the preamble to the great age whose golden days we can as yet but dimly visualize. The passionate and violent happenings that have in recent years strained to almost the point of complete breakdown the political and economic structure of society are too numerous and complex to attempt within the limitations of this general survey to arrive at an adequate estimate of their character. Nor have these tribulations, grievous as they have been, seemed to have reached their climax and exerted the full force of their destructive power. The whole world, wherever and however we survey it, offers us the sad and pitiful spectacle of a vast, an enfeebled and moribund organism which is being torn politically and strangulated economically by forces it has ceased to either control or comprehend. The Great Depression, the aftermath of the severest ordeals humanity had ever experienced, the disintegration of the Versailles system, the recrudescence of militarism in its most menacing aspects, the failure of vast experiments and newborn institutions to safeguard the peace and tranquility of peoples, classes, and nations have bitterly disillusioned humanity and prostrated its spirits. Its hopes are, for the most part, shattered. Its vitality is ebbing, its life strangely disordered, its unity severely compromised. On the continent of Europe, inveterate hatreds and increasing rivalries are once more aligning its ill-fated peoples and nations into combinations destined to precipitate the most awful and implacable tribulations that mankind, through its long record of martyrdom, has suffered. On the North American continent, economic distress, industrial disorganization, widespread discontent at the abortive experiments designed to readjust an ill-balanced economy, and restlessness and fear inspired by the possibility of political entanglements in both Europe and Asia portend the approach of what may well prove to be one of the most critical phases of the history of the American Republic. Asia, still to a great extent in the grip of one of the severest trials she has in her recent history experienced, finds herself menaced on her eastern confines by the onset of forces that threaten to intensify the struggles which the growing nationalism and industrialization of her emancipated races must ultimately engender. In the heart of Africa, there blazes the fire of an atrocious and bloody war, a war which, whatever its outcome, is destined to exert through its worldwide repercussions a most disturbing influence on the races and colored nations of mankind. With no less than 10 million people under arms, drilled and instructed in the use of the most abominable engines of destruction that science has devised, with thrice that number chafing and fretting at the rule of alien races and governments, with an equally vast army of embittered citizens impotent to procure for themselves the material goods and necessities which others are deliberately destroying, with a still greater mass of human beings groaning under the burden of ever-mounting armaments and impoverished by the virtual collapse of international trade, with evils such as these, humanity would seem to be definitely entering the outer fringes of the most agonizing phase of its existence. Is it to be wondered at that in the course of a recent statement made by one of the outstanding ministers in Europe, this warning should have been deliberately uttered? If war should break out again on a major scale in Europe, it must bring the collapse of civilization as we know it in its wake. In the words of the late Lord Bryce, "If you don't end war, war will end you." "Poor Europe is in a state of neurasthenia," is the testimony of one of the most outstanding figures among its present-day dictators. It has lost its recuperative power, the vital force of cohesion, of synthesis. Another war would destroy us. "It is likely," writes one of the most eminent and learned dignitaries of the Christian Church, "there will have to be one more great conflict in Europe to definitely establish once and for all an international authority. This conflict will be the most horrible of horribles, and possibly this generation will be called on to sacrifice hundreds of thousands of lives." The disastrous failure of both the disarmament and economic conferences, the obstacles confronting the negotiations for the limitation of naval armaments, the withdrawal of two of the most powerful and heavily armed nations of the world from the activities and membership of the League of Nations, the ineptitude of the parliamentary system of government, as witnessed by recent developments in Europe and America, the inability of the leaders and exponents of the communist movement to vindicate the much-vaunted principle of the dictatorship of the proletariat. The perils and privations to which the rulers of the totalitarian states have in recent years exposed their subjects, all these demonstrate beyond the shadow of a doubt the impotence of present-day institutions to avert the calamities with which human society is being increasingly threatened. What else remains, a bewildered generation may well ask, that can repair the cleavage that is constantly widening and which may at any time engulf it? Beset on every side by the cumulative evidences of disintegration, of turmoil, and of bankruptcy, serious-minded men and women in almost every walk of life are beginning to doubt whether society as it is now organized can, through its unaided efforts, extricate itself from the slough into which it is steadily sinking. Every system, short of the unification of the human race, has been tried, repeatedly tried, and been found wanting. Wars again and again have been fought, and conferences without number have met and deliberated. Treaties, pacts, and covenants have been painstakingly negotiated, concluded, and revised. Systems of government have been patiently tested, have been continually recast and superseded. Economic plans of reconstruction have been carefully devised and meticulously executed. And yet, crisis has succeeded crisis, and the rapidity with which a perilously unstable world is declining has been correspondingly accelerated. A yawning gulf threatens to involve in one common disaster both the satisfied and dissatisfied nations, democracies and dictatorships, capitalists and wage earners, Europeans and Asiatics, Jew and Gentile, white and coloured. An angry providence, the cynic might well observe, has abandoned a hapless planet to its fate and fixed irrevocably its doom. Sore tried and disillusioned, humanity has no doubt lost its orientation and would seem to have lost as well its faith and hope. It is hovering, unshepherded and visionless, on the brink of disaster. A sense of fatality seems to pervade it. An ever-deepening gloom is settling on its fortunes as she recedes further and further from the outer fringes of the darkest zone of its agitated life and penetrates its very heart. And yet, while the shadows are continually deepening, might we not claim that gleams of hope, flashing intermittently on the international horizon, appear at times to relieve the darkness that encircles humanity? Would it be untrue to maintain that in a world of unsettled faith and disturbed thought, a world of steadily mounting armaments, of unquenchable hatreds and rivalries, the progress, however fitful, of the forces working in harmony with the spirit of the age can already be discerned? Though the great outcry raised by post-war nationalism is growing louder and more insistent every day, the League of Nations is, as yet, in its embryonic state, and the storm clouds that are gathering may, for a time, totally eclipse its powers and obliterate its machinery. Yet the direction in which the institution itself is operating is most significant. The voices that have been raised ever since its inception, the efforts that have been exerted, the work that has already been accomplished, foreshadow the triumphs which this presently constituted institution, or any other body that may supersede it, is destined to achieve. Baha'u'llah's principle of collective security. A general pact on security has been the central purpose towards which these efforts have, ever since the League was born, tended to converge. The Treaty of Guarantee, which in the initial stages of its development its members had considered and discussed, the debate on the Geneva Protocol, the discussion of which at a later period aroused among the nations both within the League and outside it such fierce controversy, the subsequent proposal for a United States of Europe and for the economic unification of that continent, and last but not least, the policy of sanctions initiated by its members, may be regarded as the most significant landmarks in its checkered history. That no less than 50 nations of the world, all members of the League of Nations, should have, after mature deliberation, recognized and been led to pronounce their verdict against an act of aggression which in their judgment has been deliberately committed by one of their fellow members, one of the foremost powers of Europe. That they should have, for the most part, agreed to impose collectively sanctions on the condemned aggressor, and should have succeeded in carrying out to a very great measure their decision, is no doubt an event without parallel in human history. For the first time in the history of humanity, the system of collective security foreshadowed by Baha'u'llah and explained by Abdu'l-Bahá has been seriously envisaged, discussed, and tested. For the first time in history, it has been officially recognized and publicly stated that for this system of collective security to be effectively established, strength and elasticity are both essential. Strength, involving the use of an adequate force to ensure the efficacy of the proposed system, and elasticity to enable the machinery that has been devised to meet the legitimate needs and aspirations of its aggrieved upholders. For the first time in human history, tentative efforts have been exerted by the nations of the world to assume collective responsibility and to supplement their verbal pledges by actual preparation for collective action. And again, for the first time in history, a movement of public opinion has manifested itself in support of the verdict, which the leaders and representatives of nations have pronounced, and for securing collective action in pursuance of such a decision. How clear, how prophetic must sound the words uttered by Baha'u'llah in the light of recent international developments. Be united, O concourse of the sovereigns of the world, for thereby will the tempest of discord be stilled amongst you, and your peoples find rest. Should any one among you take up arms against another, rise ye all against him, for this is naught but manifest justice. The time must come, he foreshadowing the tentative efforts that are now being made, has written, when the imperative necessity for the holding of a vast and all-embracing assemblage of men will be universally realized. The rulers and kings of the earth must needs attend it, and participating in its deliberations must consider such ways and means as will lay the foundations of the world's great peace among men. Should any king take up arms against another, all should unitedly arise and prevent him. The sovereigns of the world, writes Abdu'l-Bahá in elaboration of this theme, must conclude a binding treaty and establish a covenant, the provisions of which shall be sound, inviolable, and definite. They must proclaim it to all the world and obtain for it the sanction of all the human race. All the forces of humanity must be mobilized to ensure the stability and permanence of this most great covenant. The fundamental principles underlying this solemn pact should be so fixed that if any government later violate any one of its provisions, all the governments on earth should arise to reduce it to utter submission. Nay, the human race as a whole should resolve, with every power at its disposal, to destroy that government. There can be no doubt whatever that what has already been accomplished, significant and unexampled though it is in the history of mankind, still immeasurably falls short of the essential requirements of the system which these words foreshadow. The League of Nations, its opponents will observe, still lacks the universality which is the prerequisite of abiding success in the efficacious settlement of international disputes. The United States of America, its begetter, has repudiated it and is still holding aloft, while Germany and Japan, who ranked among its most powerful supporters, have abandoned its cause and withdrawn from its membership. The decisions arrived at and the action thus far taken, others will maintain, should be regarded as no more than a magnificent gesture rather than a conclusive evidence of international solidarity. Still others may contend that though such a verdict has been pronounced and such pledges been given, collective action must, in the end, fail in its ultimate purpose, and that the League itself will perish and be submerged by the flood of tribulations destined to overtake the whole race. Be that as it may, the significance of the steps already taken cannot be ignored. Whatever the present status of the League or the outcome of its historic verdict, whatever the trials and reverses which, in the immediate future, it may have to face and sustain, the fact must be recognized that so important a decision marks one of the most distinctive milestones on the long and arduous road that must lead it to its goal, the stage at which the oneness of the whole body of nations will be made the ruling principle of international life. This historic step, however, is but a faint glimmer in the darkness that envelops an agitated humanity. It may well prove to be no more than a mere flash, a fugitive gleam, in the midst of an ever-deepening confusion. The process of disintegration must inexorably continue, and its corrosive influence must penetrate deeper and deeper into the very core of a crumbling age. Much suffering will still be required ere the contending nations, creeds, classes, and races of mankind are fused in the crucible of universal affliction and are forged by the fires of a fierce ordeal into one organic commonwealth, one vast, unified, and harmoniously functioning system. Adversities unimaginably appalling, undreamed of crises and upheavals, war, famine, and pestilence might well combine to engrave in the soul of an unheeding generation those truths and principles which it has disdained to recognize and follow. A paralysis more painful than any it has yet experienced must creep over and further afflict the fabric of a broken society ere it can be rebuilt and regenerated. The civilization, writes Baha'u'llah, so often vaunted by the learned exponents of arts and sciences, will, if allowed to overleap the bounds of moderation, bring great evil upon men. If carried to excess, civilization will prove as prolific a source of evil as it had been of goodness when kept within the restraints of moderation. The day is approaching when its flame will devour the cities, when the tongue of grandeur will proclaim, "The kingdom is God's, the Almighty the All-Praised. From the moment the Surah Ra'is tablet to Ra'is was revealed, he further explains, until the present day, neither hath the world been tranquilized, nor have the hearts of its peoples been at rest. Its sickness is approaching the stage of utter hopelessness, inasmuch as the true physician is debarred from administering the remedy, whilst unskilled practitioners are regarded with favour and are accorded full freedom to act. The dust of sedition hath clouded the hearts of men and blinded their eyes. Ere long they will perceive the consequences of what their hands have wrought in the day of God. This is the day, he again has written, whereon the earth shall tell out her tidings. The workers of iniquity are her burdens. The crier hath cried out, and men have been torn away, so great hath been the fury of his wrath. The people of the left hand sigh and bemoan. The people of the right abide in noble habitations. They quaff the wine that is life indeed from the hands of the All-Merciful, and are verily the blissful. Community of the Most Great Name. Who else can be the blissful, if not the community of the Most Great Name, whose world-embracing, continually consolidating activities constitute the one integrating process in a world whose institutions, secular as well as religious, are for the most part dissolving? They indeed are the people of the right, whose noble habitation is fixed on the foundations of the world order of Baha'u'llah, the ark of everlasting salvation in this most grievous day. Of all the kindreds of the earth, they alone can recognize, amidst the welter of a tempestuous age, the hand of the divine Redeemer that traces its course and controls its destinies. They alone are aware of the silent growth of that orderly world polity whose fabric they themselves are weaving. Conscious of their high calling, confident in the society-building power which their faith possesses, they press forward, undeterred and undismayed, in their efforts to fashion and perfect the necessary instruments wherein the embryonic world order of Baha'u'llah can mature and develop. It is this building process, slow and unobtrusive, to which the life of the worldwide Baha'i community is wholly consecrated, that constitutes the one hope of a stricken society. For this process is actuated by the generating influence of God's changeless purpose and is evolving within the framework of the administrative order of his faith. In a world the structure of whose political and social institutions is impaired, whose vision is befogged, whose conscience is bewildered, whose religious systems have become anemic and lost their virtue, this healing agency, this leavening power, this cementing force, intensely alive and all-pervasive, has been taking shape, is crystallizing into institutions, is mobilizing its forces, and is preparing for the spiritual conquest and the complete redemption of mankind. Though the society which incarnates its ideals be small, and its direct and tangible benefits as yet inconsiderable, yet the potentialities with which it has been endowed, and through which it is destined to regenerate the individual and rebuild a broken world, are incalculable. For well nigh a century, it has, amid the noise and tumult of a distracted age, and despite the incessant persecutions to which its leaders, institutions, and followers have been subjected, succeeded in preserving its identity, in reinforcing its stability and strength, in maintaining its organic unity, in preserving the integrity of its laws and its principles, in erecting its defences, and in extending and consolidating its institutions. Numerous and powerful have been the forces that have schemed, both from within and from without, in lands both far and near, to quench its light and abolish its holy name. Some have apostatized from its principles and betrayed ignominiously its cause. Others have hurled against it the fiercest anathemas which the embittered leaders of any ecclesiastical institution are able to pronounce. Still others have heaped upon it the afflictions and humiliations which sovereign authority can alone, in the plenitude of its power, inflict. The utmost its avowed and secret enemies could hope to achieve was to retard its growth and obscure momentarily its purpose. What they actually accomplished was to purge and purify its life, to stir it to still greater depths, to galvanize its soul, to prune its institutions and cement its unity. A schism, a permanent cleavage in the vast body of its adherents, they could never create. They who betrayed its cause, its lukewarm and faint-hearted supporters, withered away and dropped as dead leaves, powerless to cloud its radiance or to imperil its structure. Its most implacable adversaries, they who assailed it from without, were hurled from power and in the most astonishing fashion met their doom. Persia had been the first to repress and oppose it. Its monarchs had miserably fallen, their dynasty had collapsed, their name was execrated, the hierarchy that had been their ally and had propped their declining state had been utterly discredited. Turkey, which had thrice banished its founder and inflicted on him cruel and lifelong imprisonment, had passed through one of the severest ordeals and far-reaching revolutions that its history has recorded, had shrunk from one of the most powerful empires to a tiny Asiatic republic, its sultanate obliterated, its dynasty overthrown, its caliphate, the mightiest institution of Islam, abolished. Meanwhile, the faith that had been the object of such monstrous betrayals and the target for such woeful assaults was going from strength to strength, was forging ahead, undaunted and undivided by the injuries it had received. In the midst of trials, it had inspired its loyal followers with a resolution that no obstacle, however formidable, could undermine. It had lighted in their hearts a faith that no misfortune, however black, could quench. It had infused into their hearts a hope that no force, however determined, could shatter. A world religion. Ceasing to designate to itself a movement, a fellowship and the like, designations that did grave injustice to its ever-unfolding system, disassociating itself from such appellations as Babi sect, Asiatic cult, and offshoot of Shia Islam, with which the ignorant and the malicious were wont to describe it, refusing to be labelled as a mere philosophy of life, or as an eclectic code of ethical conduct, or even as a new religion. The faith of Baha'u'llah is now visibly succeeding in demonstrating its claim and title to be regarded as a world religion, destined to attain, in the fullness of time, the status of a world-embracing commonwealth, which would be at once the instrument and the guardian of the most great peace announced by its author. Far from wishing to add to the number of the religious systems whose conflicting loyalties have for so many generations disturbed the peace of mankind, this faith is instilling into each of its adherents a new love for and a genuine appreciation of the unity underlying the various religions represented within its pale. It is like a wide embrace. Such is the testimony of royalty to its claim and position, gathering together all those who have long searched for words of hope. It accepts all great prophets gone before it, destroys no other creeds, and leaves all doors open. The Baha'i teaching, she has further written, brings peace to the soul and hope to the heart. To those in search of assurance, the words of the Father are as a fountain in the desert after long wandering. Their writings, she, in another statement, referring to Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá, has testified, are a great cry towards peace, reaching beyond all limits of frontiers, above all dissension about rights and dogmas. It is a wondrous message that Baha'u'llah and his son Abdu'l-Bahá have given us. They have not set it up aggressively, knowing that the germ of eternal truth, which lies at its core, cannot but take root and spread. If ever the name of Baha'u'llah or Abdu'l-Bahá, is her concluding plea, comes to your attention, do not put their writings from you. Search out their books and let their glorious, peace-bringing, love-creating words and lessons sink into your hearts as they have into mine. The faith of Baha'u'llah has assimilated, by virtue of its creative, its regulative, and ennobling energies, the varied races, nationalities, creeds, and classes that have sought its shadow and have pledged unswerving fealty to its cause. It has changed the hearts of its adherents, burned away their prejudices, stilled their passions, exalted their conceptions, ennobled their motives, coordinated their efforts, and transformed their outlook. While preserving their patriotism and safeguarding their lesser loyalties, it has made them lovers of mankind and the determined upholders of its best and truest interests. While maintaining intact their belief in the divine origin of their respective religions, it has enabled them to visualize the underlying purpose of these religions, to discover their merits, to recognize their sequence, their interdependence, their wholeness and unity, and to acknowledge the bond that vitally links them to itself. This universal, this transcending love which the followers of the Baha'i faith feel for their fellow men of whatever race, creed, class, or nation is neither mysterious nor can it be said to have been artificially stimulated. It is both spontaneous and genuine. They whose hearts are warmed by the energizing influence of God's creative love cherish his creatures for his sake and recognize in every human face a sign of his reflected glory. Of such men and women, it may be truly said that to them every foreign land is a fatherland, and every fatherland a foreign land. For their citizenship, it must be remembered, is in the kingdom of Baha'u'llah. Though willing to share to the utmost the temporal benefits and the fleeting joys which this earthly life can confer, though eager to participate in whatever activity that conduces to the richness, the happiness, and peace of that life, they can at no time forget that it constitutes no more than a transient a very brief stage of their existence, that they who live it are but pilgrims and wayfarers whose goal is the celestial city and whose home is the country of never-failing joy and brightness. Though loyal to their respective governments, though profoundly interested in anything that affects their security and welfare, though anxious to share in whatever promotes their best interests, the faith with which the followers of Baha'u'llah stand identified is one which they firmly believe God has raised high above the storms, the divisions, and the controversies of the political arena. Their faith they conceive to be essentially non-political, supranational in character, rigidly non-partisan, and entirely disassociated from nationalistic ambitions, pursuits, and purposes. Such a faith knows no division of class or of party. It subordinates, without hesitation or equivocation, every particularistic interest, be it personal, regional, or national, to the paramount interests of humanity, firmly convinced that in a world of interdependent peoples and nations, the advantage of the part is best to be reached by the advantage of the whole, and that no abiding benefit can be conferred upon the component parts if the general interests of the entity itself are ignored or neglected. Small wonder if by the pen of Baha'u'llah these pregnant words, written in anticipation of the present state of mankind, should have been revealed. It is not for him to pride himself who loveth his own country, but rather for him who loveth the whole world. The earth is but one country, and mankind its citizens. And again, that one indeed is a man who today dedicateth himself to the service of the entire human race. Through the power released by these exalted words, he explains, he hath lent a fresh impulse and set a new direction to the birds of men's hearts, and hath obliterated every trace of restriction and limitation from God's holy book. Their faith, Baha'is firmly believe, is moreover undenominational, non-sectarian, and wholly divorced from every ecclesiastical system, whatever its form, origin, or activities. No ecclesiastical organization, with its creeds, its traditions, its limitations, and exclusive outlook, can be said, as is the case with all existing political factions, parties, systems, and programs, to conform in all its aspects to the cardinal tenets of Baha'i belief. To some of these principles and ideals animating political and ecclesiastical institutions, every conscientious follower of the faith of Baha'u'llah can no doubt readily subscribe. With none of these institutions, however, can he identify himself, nor can he unreservedly endorse the creeds, the principles, and programs on which they are based. How can a faith, it should moreover be borne in mind, whose divinely ordained institutions have been established within the jurisdiction of no less than 40 different countries, the policies and interests of whose governments are continually clashing and growing more complex and confused every day. How can such a faith, by allowing its adherents, whether individually or through its organized councils, to meddle in political activities, succeed in preserving the integrity of its teachings and in safeguarding the unity of its followers? How can it ensure the vigorous, the uninterrupted and peaceful development of its expanding institutions? How can a faith whose ramifications have brought it into contact with mutually incompatible religious systems, sects and confessions be in a position, if it permits its adherents to subscribe to obsolete observations and doctrines, to claim the unconditional allegiance of those whom it is striving to incorporate into its divinely appointed system? How can it avoid the constant friction, the misunderstandings and controversies which formal affiliation, as distinct from association, must inevitably engender? These directing and regulating principles of Baha'i belief, the upholders of the cause of Baha'u'llah feel bound as their administrative order expands and consolidates itself to assert and vigilantly apply. The exigencies of a slowly crystallizing faith impose upon them a duty which they cannot shirk, a responsibility which they cannot evade. Nor are they unmindful of the imperative necessity of upholding and of executing the laws as distinguished from the principles ordained by Baha'u'llah, both of which constitute the warp and woof of the institutions upon which the structure of his world order must ultimately rest. To demonstrate their usefulness and efficacy, to carry out and apply them, to safeguard their integrity, to grasp their implications and to facilitate their propagation, Baha'i communities in the East and recently in the West are displaying the utmost effort and are willing, if necessary, to make whatever sacrifices may be demanded. The day may not be far distant when in certain countries of the East in which religious communities exercise jurisdiction in matters of personal status, Baha'i assemblies may be called upon to assume the duties and responsibilities devolving upon officially constituted Baha'i courts. They will be empowered in such matters as marriage, divorce, and inheritance to execute and apply within their respective jurisdictions and with the sanction of civil authorities such laws and ordinances as have been expressly provided in their most holy book. The faith of Baha'u'llah has, in addition to these tendencies and activities which its evolution is now revealing, demonstrated in other spheres and wherever the illumination of its light has penetrated, the force of its cohesive strength, of its integrating power, of its invincible spirit. In the erection and consecration of its house of worship in the heart of the North American continent, in the construction and multiplication of its administrative headquarters in the land of its birth and in neighboring countries, in the fashioning of the legal instruments designed to safeguard and regulate the corporate life of its institutions, in the accumulation of adequate resources, material as well as cultural, in every continent of the globe, in the endowments which it has created for itself in the immediate surroundings of its shrines at its world center, in the efforts that are being made for the collection, the verification, and the systematization of the writings of its founders, in the measures that are being taken for the acquisition of such historical sites as are associated with the lives of its forerunner and its author, its heroes and martyrs, in the foundations that are being laid for the gradual formation and establishment of its educational, its cultural and humanitarian institutions, in the vigorous efforts that are being exerted to safeguard the character, stimulate the initiative and coordinate the worldwide activities of its youth, in the extraordinary vitality with which its valiant defenders, its elected representatives, its itinerant teachers and pioneer administrators are pleading its cause, extending its boundaries, enriching its literature and strengthening the basis of its spiritual conquests and triumphs. In the recognition which civil authorities have in certain instances been induced to grant to the body of its local and national representatives, enabling them to incorporate their councils, establish their subsidiary institutions, and safeguard their endowments. In the facilities which these same authorities have consented to accord to its shrines, its consecrated edifices and educational institutions, in the enthusiasm and determination with which certain communities that had been severely tested and harassed are resuming their activities. In the spontaneous tributes paid by royalty, princes, statesmen, and scholars to the sublimity of its cause and the station of its founders. In these, as in many others, the faith of Baha'u'llah is proving beyond doubt its virility and capacity to counteract the disintegrating influences to which religious systems, moral standards, and political and social institutions are being subjected. From Iceland to Tasmania, from Vancouver to the China Sea, spreads the radiance and extend the ramifications of this world-enfolding system, this many-hued and firmly knit fraternity, infusing into every man and woman it has won to its cause a faith, a hope, and a vigour that a wayward generation has long lost and is powerless to recover. They who preside over the immediate destinies of this troubled world, they who are responsible for its chaotic state, its fears, its doubts, its miseries, will do well in their bewilderment to fix their gaze and ponder in their hearts upon the evidences of this saving grace of the Almighty that lies within their reach, a grace that can ease their burden, resolve their perplexities, and illuminate their path. Divine retribution. The whole of mankind is groaning, is dying to be led to unity and to terminate its age-long martyrdom. And yet, it stubbornly refuses to embrace the light and acknowledge the sovereign authority of the one power that can extricate it from its entanglements and avert the woeful calamity that threatens to engulf it. Ominous indeed is the voice of Baha'u'llah that rings through these prophetic words. O ye peoples of the world, know verily that an unforeseen calamity followeth you, and grievous retribution awaiteth you. Think not that which ye have committed hath been effaced in my sight. And again, we have a fixed time for you, O peoples. If ye fail at the appointed hour to turn towards God, he verily will lay violent hold on you and will cause grievous afflictions to assail you from every direction. How severe indeed is the chastisement with which your Lord will then chastise you. Must humanity, tormented as she now is, be afflicted with still severer tribulations ere their purifying influence can prepare her to enter the heavenly kingdom destined to be established upon earth? Must the inauguration of so vast, so unique, so illumined an era in human history be ushered in by so great a catastrophe in human affairs as to recall, nay, surpass the appalling collapse of Roman civilization in the first centuries of the Christian era? Must a series of profound convulsions stir and rock the human race ere Baha'u'llah can be enthroned in the hearts and consciences of the masses, ere his undisputed ascendancy is universally recognized, and the noble edifice of his world order is reared and established? The long ages of infancy and childhood through which the human race had to pass have receded into the background. Humanity is now experiencing the commotions invariably associated with the most turbulent age of its evolution, the stage of adolescence, when the impetuosity of youth and its vehemence reach their climax and must gradually be superseded by the calmness, the wisdom, and the maturity that characterize the stage of manhood. Then will the human race reach that stature of ripeness which will enable it to acquire all the powers and capacities upon which its ultimate development must depend. World unity, the goal. Unification of the whole of mankind is the hallmark of the stage which human society is now approaching. Unity of family, of tribe, of city-state and nation have been successively attempted and fully established. World unity is the goal towards which a harassed humanity is striving. Nation building has come to an end. The anarchy inherent in state sovereignty is moving towards a climax. A world growing to maturity must abandon this fetish, recognize the oneness and wholeness of human relationships, and establish once for all the machinery that can best incarnate this fundamental principle of its life. A new life, Baha'u'llah proclaims, is in this age stirring within all the peoples of the earth, and yet none hath discovered its cause or perceived its motive. O ye children of men, he thus addresses his generation, the fundamental purpose animating the faith of God and his religion is to safeguard the interests and promote the unity of the human race. This is the straight path, the fixed and immovable foundation. Whatsoever is raised on this foundation, the changes and chances of the world can never impair its strength, nor will the revolution of countless centuries undermine its structure. The well-being of mankind, he declares, its peace and security are unattainable unless and until its unity is firmly established. So powerful is the light of unity, is his further testimony, that it can illuminate the whole earth. The one true God, he who knoweth all things, himself testifieth to the truth of these words. This goal excelleth every other goal, and this aspiration is the monarch of all aspirations. He who is your Lord, the All-Merciful, he moreover has written, cherisheth in his heart the desire of beholding the entire human race as one soul and one body. Haste ye to win your share of God's good grace and mercy in this day that eclipseth all other created days. The unity of the human race, as envisaged by Baha'u'llah, implies the establishment of a world commonwealth in which all nations, races, creeds, and classes are closely and permanently united, and in which the autonomy of its state members and the personal freedom and initiative of the individuals that compose them are definitely and completely safeguarded. This commonwealth must, as far as we can visualize it, consist of a world legislature whose members will, as the trustees of the whole of mankind, ultimately control the entire resources of all the component nations and will enact such laws as shall be required to regulate the life, satisfy the needs, and adjust the relationships of all races and peoples. A world executive, backed by an international force, will carry out the decisions arrived at and apply the laws enacted by this world legislature, and will safeguard the organic unity of the whole Commonwealth. A world tribunal will adjudicate and deliver its compulsory and final verdict in all and any disputes that may arise between the various elements constituting this universal system. A mechanism of world intercommunication will be devised, embracing the whole planet, freed from national hindrances and restrictions, and functioning with marvelous swiftness and perfect regularity. A world metropolis will act as the nerve center of a world civilization, the focus towards which the unifying forces of life will converge and from which its energizing influences will radiate. A world language will either be invented or chosen from among the existing languages and will be taught in the schools of all the Federated Nations as an auxiliary to their mother tongue. A world script, a world literature, a uniform and universal system of currency, of weights and measures, will simplify and facilitate intercourse and understanding among the nations and races of mankind. In such a world society, science and religion, the two most potent forces in human life, will be reconciled, will cooperate, and will harmoniously develop. The press will, under such a system, while giving full scope to the expression of the diversified views and convictions of mankind, cease to be mischievously manipulated by vested interests, whether private or public, and will be liberated from the influence of contending governments and peoples. The economic resources of the world will be organized, its sources of raw materials will be tapped and fully utilized, its markets will be coordinated and developed, and the distribution of its products will be equitably regulated. National rivalries, hatreds, and intrigues will cease, and racial animosity and prejudice will be replaced by racial amity, understanding, and cooperation. The causes of religious strife will be permanently removed. Economic barriers and restrictions will be completely abolished, and the inordinate distinction between classes will be obliterated. Destitution on the one hand and gross accumulation of ownership on the other will disappear. The enormous energy dissipated and wasted on war, whether economic or political, will be consecrated to such ends as will extend the range of human inventions and technical development, to the increase of the productivity of mankind, to the extermination of disease, to the extension of scientific research, to the raising of the standard of physical health, to the sharpening and refinement of the human brain, to the exploitation of the unused and unsuspected resources of the planet, to the prolongation of human life, and to the furtherance of any other agency that can stimulate the intellectual, the moral, and spiritual life of the entire human race. A world federal system, ruling the whole earth and exercising unchallengeable authority over its unimaginably vast resources, blending and embodying the ideals of both the East and the West, liberated from the curse of war and its miseries, and bent on the exploitation of all the available sources of energy on the surface of the planet. A system in which force is made the servant of justice, whose life is sustained by its universal recognition of one God and by its allegiance to one common revelation. Such is the goal towards which humanity, impelled by the unifying forces of life, is moving. one of the great events, affirms Abdu'l-Bahá, which is to occur in the day of the manifestation of that incomparable branch, is the hoisting of the standard of God among all nations. By this is meant that all nations and kindreds will be gathered together under the shadow of this divine banner, which is no other than the lordly branch itself, and will become a single nation. Religious and sectarian antagonism, the hostility of races and peoples, and differences among nations will be eliminated. All men will adhere to one religion, will have one common faith, will be blended into one race and become a single people. All will dwell in one common fatherland, which is the planet itself. Now in the world of being, he has moreover explained, the hand of divine power hath firmly laid the foundations of this all-highest bounty and this wondrous gift. Whatsoever is latent in the innermost of this holy cycle shall gradually appear and be made manifest, for now is but the beginning of its growth and the dayspring of the revelation of its signs. Ere the close of this century and of this age, it shall be made clear and evident how wondrous was that springtide, and how heavenly was that gift. No less enthralling is the vision of Isaiah, the greatest of the Hebrew prophets, predicting, as far back as 2,500 years ago, the destiny which mankind must at its stage of maturity achieve. And he, the Lord, shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots, and he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked, and righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and the suckling child shall play on the hole of the asp, and the wean child shall put his hand on the cockatrice's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. The writer of the Apocalypse, prefiguring the millennial glory which a redeemed, a jubilant humanity must witness, has similarly testified. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. Who can doubt that such a consummation, the coming of age of the human race, must signalize in its turn the inauguration of a world civilization such as no mortal eye hath ever beheld or human mind conceived? Who is it that can imagine the lofty standard which such a civilization, as it unfolds itself is destined to attain. Who can measure the heights to which human intelligence, liberated from its shackles, will soar? Who can visualize the realms which the human spirit, vitalized by the outpouring light of Baha'u'llah, shining in the plenitude of its glory, will discover? What more fitting conclusion to this theme than these words of Baha'u'llah, written in anticipation of the golden age of his faith, the age in which the face of the earth from pole to pole will mirror the ineffable splendors of the Abha Paradise. This is the day whereon naught can be seen except the splendors of the light that shineth from the face of thy Lord, the gracious, the most bountiful. Verily, we have caused every soul to expire by virtue of our irresistible and all-subduing sovereignty. We have then called into being a new creation as a token of our grace unto men. I am verily the all-bountiful, the Ancient of Days. This is the day whereon the unseen world crieth out, "Great is thy blessedness, O earth, for thou hast been made the footstool of thy God, and been chosen as the seat of his mighty throne." The realm of glory exclaimeth, "Would that my life could be sacrificed for thee, for he who is the beloved of the All-Merciful hath established his sovereignty upon thee through the power of his name that hath been promised unto all things, whether of the past or of the future." Shoghi, Haifa, Palestine, March 11th, 1936.